The Transfiguration by Carolyn Arends. Moses. Jesus said something about meeting on the mountains again, and all three of us laughed. I have to admit, hovering that close to terra firma, smelling those old earth smells on the current of a dusty wind, Sinai came rushing back to me. I could almost hear that ancient trumpet. I could taste that oddly fragrant smoke. For a moment, I felt the old tingle in my nerve endings, the knot in my stomach. Even now, my muscles seem to store in their memories a sensation of turning to jelly in the midst of that presence. Jesus was grinning at me. It was so strange to see him contained in skin, whiskered, and just a little wizened from 30 years of sun. He turned to gaze out over the valley. "How does that promised land look?" he asked. And I thought about all those old yearnings, the way I had strained towards the promises, the longing for plenty, for peace, for home. I turned to look straight into his eyes. "You look great," he chuckled. He was starting to flicker, first like a burning bush, and then bursting out brighter, closer and closer to the way that he looks now on the throne. Elijah was squinting at him, mesmerized as always. Jesus was the promised land, all right. But another nickname was coming to mind now. "Shekinah," I whispered. "It's almost time." "I know," he said. "One last exodus." I told him that he was not alone, that soon it would be finished. Things he already knew, of course. I started to tell him how glad I was that he had fulfilled the law. He laughed again. "You and the law," he said. And then, touching my arm, he whispered, "You did good, you know." I felt his love move through me like milk and honey, the way it always does. And I began to say in Kronos what we live to sing in Kairos. "Thank you. I love you. Holy."
Elijah. Jesus said something about meeting on the mountains again, and all three of us laughed. I don't know if he was thinking of Horeb or of Carmel. They were both hovering in my mind's eye like mirages. The sound of Jesus' voice always puts me back in the cave, of course, remembering the shock of finding in the whisper what was absent in the earthquake. But a recent rain had left the Tabor trees heavy and damp. So how could I not also think of water-soaked Carmel? Of that instant when the first log sparked and crackled, and I almost fainted with relief. Jesus was talking to Moses. I was staring. It was so strange to see him earthbound, dust on his sandals, blisters on his toes. "How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of him," I murmured. Jesus turned and put his hand on my shoulder. "That Isaiah," he grinned, "is quite the prophet." Even as he chuckled, he was starting to radiate, heat pouring off him like wood on the altar, more and more like his usual self. Moses was doing what he could to minister to him, the way the Father requested. But what can the servants give to the king? I cleared my throat. "Soon," I began, "the world will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back." He reached out his hand again, steadying me as I hung, vibrating in that odd twilight between heaven and earth. "Yes, Elijah," he said. Yes, they will. I felt his love move through me like a mountain breeze, the way it always does. And I began to say in Kronos what we live to sing in Kairos. Thank you. I love you. Holy.
Peter. Jesus said something about meeting on the mountains again, and all three of them laughed. I thought I was dreaming, of course. Wouldn't you? But I willed myself awake and gave my head a shake. I didn't dare get up. I shielded my eyes with my hand and made out three figures, Jesus and two others. I can't even tell you how I knew it was them. Moses, for heaven's sakes, and Elijah. I just knew it in my gut instantly. The way I knew, whenever the winds were right, where to find fish. Or the way my wife seems to sense it every time there was a new little life in her belly. Or the way, only a few days earlier, I had finally known in a flash who Jesus really was. They were talking, teasing each other. It seemed in a warm, relaxed way of old friends. And then they were looking out over the valley, confiding in low and serious tones, bent over the world like doctors conferring over a patient. After a while, I didn't recognize the language anymore. All vowels and air, more music than speech. Jesus started to glow. You know, when the sun hits the surface of a lake so bright and so hard that you feel like your eyes will catch fire? That's how it looked. That's how it started. After a while, it was too much and I had to look away. I could see James and John doubled over, shaking, cowering, like me. Out of the corner of my watering eye, I saw Moses start to float up. Elijah, too. I couldn't stand it. I panicked. I'm not proud of it. I started babbling, something about tents and keeping them there. I wanted to do something. I wanted the world to see what I saw, to know what I knew. Jesus was giving me that, oh, Peter, look. They left, of course. But I didn't have time to mourn because a cloud settled in and there was a voice. The voice. This is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him. That's a direct quote. Eventually, the cloud lifted and the glow slowly faded until Jesus was just Jesus again. I felt cold. When I shivered, he came over and put his arm across my shoulders. I felt his love move through me like a beach fire, the way it always does. And for once, I couldn't think of a single thing to say. It's different now. Now I sing in Kairos what I struggle to say in Kronos. Thank you. I love you. Holy.
Weird. That's what I say. Just plain weird. I mean, when is the last time you went hiking and one of your party started to glow, let alone turn dazzling white? And then Moses and Elijah show up, and there's this voice from heaven. What is going on? What are we supposed to make of this? And what in the world does it have to do with us? One of the challenges that we have for understanding the New Testament is that, unlike the writers and the first readers, our minds are not saturated with the scriptures of the Old Testament. Here are some of the Old Testament allusions that Luke uses in telling this story. Jesus' face being transformed and his clothes becoming dazzling white is reminiscent of heavenly visions, like Ezekiel's vision of the chariot coming down out of heaven, chariot that went this way and that, representing the throne of God. Moses and Elijah, these are two key people associated with Mount Sinai. Moses was key in forming the nation of Israel. After meeting with God, his face shone when he came down the mountain carrying the tablets of the Ten Commandments. Elijah was key in reforming the nation of Israel. After his confrontation with King Ahab and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, he fled to Mount Sinai, where he received instruction from God about coming judgment and salvation. Moses and Elijah were also important figures in Jewish expectation, speaking about the coming day of the Lord, when God would restore all things. The prophet Malachi wrote, "Remember the teaching of my servant Moses. Lo, I will send to you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes." So the appearance of Moses and Elijah suggests something climactic in the story of Israel, and that restoration is afoot. The three of them spoke about Jesus' departure that was about to happen in Jerusalem. Departure is not merely a euphemistic way of speaking about somebody's death. Kim's translation got it right, actually. The word is exodus. They were speaking about Jesus' exodus. Jesus' death was going to be an exodus experience, as with Israel of old. God would liberate his people from slavery and lead them into new life. It is a story of restoration. Peter suggests that they set up three tents, one for Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah. He wasn't totally out of his mind. He got the Exodus theme. Mention of tents reminds us of Israel living in tents in the wilderness after being liberated from Egypt. And it reminds us of the tabernacle that Moses set up where God's glory lived. And Jews remembered this period of their history every year at the Feast of Tabernacles. The appearance of a cloud. And since we're brought into the story of the Exodus, the cloud reminds us of how God was present to his people. Mysterious, but very real. The Israelites looked towards the wilderness, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And finally, the voice from heaven, "This is my son, the chosen, listen to him." The words are reminiscent of what God says about the servant of the Lord figure in Isaiah. "Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen in whom my soul delights." But of course, those of us who have been reading the gospel story are immediately reminded of the heavenly voice at Jesus' baptism. "You are my son, the beloved. With you I am well pleased." And so Jesus' transfiguration brings together all these themes. Themes of liberation, of exodus, the hope for restoration, of the presence of God, and of the special role that Jesus plays in all of this. What a great text for last Sunday in Epiphany. I think it is important for us, though, not to lose sight of the weirdness of this incident. Important for us at Grandview. We are a highly educated church. I don't know if I've ever known a church with such a high percentage of graduate degrees. Ordinarily, I would have thought that that might be intimidating to others. But somehow I don't think that happens here. We seem to have found a way of leaving our credentials at the door. and being brothers and sisters. It's great if you want to do more education, more training, but we're not going to think more of you if you do, and we're not going to think less of you if you don't. And yet there's something important in today's scripture, particularly for the educated. I think it's this: at the end of the day, we can't figure it all out. Yeah, we can figure a lot out. It's good to use whatever training we have as we seek to follow Jesus. But even when we pool all our resources together, there's still mystery. There's still transcendence. Indeed, there is still a whole world of reality that we only scratch the surface of. We are very far from having an all-knowing perspective, and we must confess that in ourselves we are not adequate for the tasks before us. At the end of the day, we bring all we have, and more often than not, that amounts to not much more than five rolls and two small fish. And we lay it at Jesus' feet and we say, "Could you do something with these? Because I can't seem to feed all these people." So we need to remember mystery. We need to remember transcendence. And this was important for Jesus' disciples too. Just before this incident in Luke 9, Peter says, "What we readers knew from the beginning of the gospel, that Jesus is the Messiah of God." And yet immediately, Jesus tells his disciples not to say that to anyone else. And he warns them that they're going up to Jerusalem and he's going to be killed. And whenever a group knows that it is going to lose its esteemed leader, there is sorrow. But for Jesus' disciples, there's something more going on. For Jews, a crucified Messiah is a contradiction in terms, like jumbo shrimp, deafening silence, clean coal, military intelligence. Sorry, Bob. Crucified Messiah? Disciples must have been wondering what is going on. Have I joined the wrong movement? Should I be looking elsewhere? Is there no hope after all? Perhaps we have more in common with this gospel text than we first thought. Things had been going quite well, you see. Sick people were being healed. There's Peter's mother-in-law, there are lepers, paralytics, many others. Indeed, one young man had been raised from the dead. Evil spirits were being cast out. Jesus gave a cracking sermon, giving hope to the oppressed and challenging the privileged. It was true, as Jesus said, the blind receive the sight, the lame walk. Lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. But now we wonder, are those in power going to put a stop to all this? Would the prophecy of Mary really be fulfilled? He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, according to the promise he made to our ancestors, to Abraham and his descendants forever. What about Jesus' sermon in the synagogue in Nazareth? "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Was Jesus correct in saying that this scripture was being fulfilled? Was it all going to be for naught? Perhaps John the Baptist was right in questioning whether Jesus really was the Messiah. Was Jesus going to go the way of all other messianic pretenders of the day? Create some excitement among the crowds only to be squelched by the Romans? People join churches for all kinds of reasons. You like the pattern of worship. You like the preaching. You like the children's ministry. You like the songs they sing. I think a lot of people come to Grandview because they're looking for something different. Looking for something more than pious words used to justify middle-class values and right-wing politics. Grandview is a church that for the last 30 years has been asking, so what does it mean to be followers of Jesus in this particular neighborhood? How do we understand our calling to be followers of Jesus in light of the needs of people where we live? This impulse to mission is deep within our DNA. The Christian calling affects how we live. It challenges us to love our neighbors in tangible ways. And so people around here have gotten involved in all kinds of efforts to express compassion and justice. I remember when Mary Carol and I were first looking for a church on the east side, we checked out Grandview. We appreciated the thoughtfulness that went into the worship, rough around the edges though it was. I remember being struck one Sunday, finding out what the church was doing outside of the Sunday worship service. Someone pointed out to me, and that guy works with refugees, helping them navigate their entry into Canada. That lady works with prostituted women on the downtown east side. That lady works with single moms. And that guy organizes a weekly meal at the church for people on the margins. And those people are working on a new kind of housing project that would welcome some people who might otherwise be at risk. And there's a bunch of people who provide opportunities for people to learn some employable skills, and on and on. I came to see that this was a church that was trying to take seriously the teaching of Jesus, and doing so even in costly ways, in order to make a difference in the community. There is a danger, though, in defining ourselves by our activity. Perhaps taking pride in our ministries, in finding our identity in what we do. Because while our activities may be good and well-meant and right, we are so often not competent for the task. The problems we face are just too big. Or like the disciples in Luke 9, we get thrown into confusion and lose hope and begin to ask questions about whether we're doing the right thing after all. The transfiguration scene is there to remind us to focus on Jesus. There are a lot of great people like Moses and Elijah to help us on our way, but there's only one son. It is Jesus who welcomed people on the margins to eat with him. It is Jesus who healed those who were suffering. It is Jesus who challenged the status quo of the day. It is Jesus who critiqued the rich and powerful for oppressing others. It is Jesus who taught us to love our enemies, to do good to those who hate us, to bless those who curse us, to pray for those who abuse us. It's Jesus who proclaimed the coming kingdom of God. It's Jesus who shows us what true humanity is. It's Jesus who dies for us and shows us that even in the prospect of death, we are not without hope. It's Jesus who embraces us with the love of God. It is Jesus who connects us with God himself. Seems to me that the story of the Transfiguration is for people who are drawn to God, but who sometimes are in danger of becoming despondent and losing hope. Losing hope in our world, in our leaders, in ourselves. It's a story for us. It reminds us, especially when things are not going as we think they should, that there is a transcendent reality where God is not caught off guard. Where even though the prospects look grim, God really is about restoration, and He has not given up where there is a plan. And it's a story where we are drawn to Jesus. When we sing songs about Jesus, when we glorify Him, it's not just an exercise in Christian piety, using religious language to try to escape the conflicted lives that we have, escaping for 1 hour each week, our weekly dose of opium, if you will. No. We glorify Jesus because we find in Him a glimpse into a reality that is more real than what we can see and what we can touch. Where we encounter forgiveness and restoration, where we discover what true humanity is, where we are instilled with hope for ourselves, hope for the world, where God is truly at work, indeed, where we discover God Himself. My prayer in this year of living simply is that we take seriously the words from the cloud, "This is my son, the chosen. Listen to him."